Good evening. This is a wonderful turnout. Please find seats where you can. I would tell you to come up front, but there's really not even any seats up front. We have two up front. If I can auction them off. We could do that. Sold. There we go. My name is Mark Metzler-Sawin, and I am in the history department here at Eastern Mennonite University. And we're very pleased to have with us tonight Dr. Vincent Harding. I want to acknowledge that this is part of the Albert Enkheim lecture series that was established for one of our colleagues. And the Keim family, several of members are here, and so I want to welcome them as well. I want to also acknowledge that this has been a group effort. When news that Vincent Harding was able to come visit with us, getting sponsorship wasn't very difficult, but I wanted to acknowledge sort of the folks who helped support bring him here. The Keim Endowed Lecture Series, the Student Government Association, both the Provost and the Undergraduate Academic Dean's Offices, the Ori Miller Center, the Center for Justice and Peace Building, Campus Ministries, Multicultural and International Student Services, and also the Black Student Union sort of worked together to make this event possible. So thank you. Please also note that there's one more time that Dr. Harding will be speaking. He will be here at the seminary's chapel at 11 o'clock tomorrow, and you're welcome to attend that as well. We've had a wonderful day with Dr. Harding, and my experience has shown that 1 hour is not nearly enough, so I'm going to get off stage quite quickly here. Dr. Harding asked that we begin with a song. We're not going to sing, though we are Mennonites. We're going to listen to a song this time. So we'll begin with a song, and I'll invite Dr. Harding up, and we'll begin discussion then. There'll be plenty of time for you talking back with him. I'll be running around with this roving mic, so if you have a question, put your hand up, and I'll come to you. All right?
Come on our way.
Are you on your way?
You are some good-looking folks out there. And I am very glad to be with you. Some of you I haven't seen for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years. And I'm not sure that I will recognize and remember all the names, but know that in my heart, I recognize you. And I love you very much. And I remember both our joys and our sorrows, for all of them have been part of helping me to be who I am. And that's the reason why, as well, I asked that we could begin with that music from the Freedom Movement. As many of you know, that is the context, the setting that has done so much to shape my life. And I find it impossible to come anywhere to talk about that without bringing that music with me. And that particular piece that you were listening to, as in so much of the movement, the music was led by high schoolers. And this young woman was just singing her heart out with many of her high school comrades around her. And they were not just singing to sing nice songs. They were singing to get themselves ready to go to face the dogs and the fire hoses and the deep fears and antagonisms of those who thought that they were in charge of the world. And to have those young people and their music accompany us this afternoon, this evening, is a great privilege, because they helped to create the possibilities for this country that many people never really knew existed. And so I'm glad that they could sing, "I'm on my way." And what I know as the true meaning of that song now is that Freedom Land was not a particular place, but it was a way of being, a way of committing oneself to the transformations that had to take place in this country. And so they said they were ready to commit themselves to that work. And I brought it with me to encourage you, to encourage me, to encourage all the little children who don't even know yet that they need to be on their way. But you are with them, and you will help them to understand what that means. This morning, was it really this morning? I tried to make it very clear that what I was doing was entering into a dialogue with you. For those of you who were there, you have special responsibility because you heard that. For those of you who weren't there, we're going to bring you into the responsibility right now. What I'd like to do is ask those of you who were there this morning, or even those who were not, if you would like to start off this evening by taking a piece of your responsibility in this dialogue. I'd like to know if there's anyone who, in the course of the 10, 12 hours since we've been together, had some thoughts about this morning, had some questions about this morning, had something that you wanted to work with, wrestle with, cheer, shout out, sing out. If there was anything that you'd like to enter into now, based on what took place this morning, out of my own story or the stories that you thought of as you were listening to my story, this is your chance to start the evening off. Anyone had a thought, a question ringing in you over these last few hours? Here's your chance to start the evening off if you would like to. Mark is standing at the ready with the mic. By the way, oh good, I see a hand, wonderful. I would like to share with you what you probably already gathered, and that is that I am absolutely obsessed with the whole question of how do you build a deep democracy in this country. I am convinced that when we think about democracy, a truly multiracial, compassionate democracy, we are still a developing country. And just a small thing like the matter of always having enough supplies of hand mics so that there can be lots of opportunities for people to enter into conversation and not just to depend upon the mic that the speaker has and the voice as the only voice. I think that every democracy needs as many mics as we can possibly get, just a small matter. And I hope that you'll think about that the next time you're going into public purchases for the needs of a democratic society. The hand over here, could we follow the protocol for this morning? That everyone who speaks, let us hear their full name. Let us hear where they spent their childhood. Let us hear their mama's mama's name and where she spent her childhood. And that begins to open us up to have a sense of the fact that we're not just a crowd, but that we are trying to build a community. And the community is built most deeply when we know something about each of our stories. So that's what I'm hoping you will lead us in, dear brother.
Well, I was just going to say that my name isn't Mike. But my name is Don Clymer. And my mother's mother's name is Anna Sensenick. And she grew up and lived on the farm that was deeded to her family from William Penn in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And that's where I also spent my childhood. Okay. But I've lived many years outside of Lancaster County since then.
Thank you very much, John.
My question is this. This morning, as I listened to your presentation and talking about the different things that shaped the love in your life, I kept wondering, how is it after having faced dogs, after having faced fire hoses, that you're not angry, that all that came through this morning in your presentation to us was your love? Where do you get the depth to be able to love in spite of all the injustices that you have seen in your life and continue to see, I assume?
Don, thank you very much for the question. I think I was offering the same answer this morning that I would give now. I have been totally enwrapped in love from others. That's where my capacity to love comes from. It's no magic that I have. I have simply been loved by so many magnificent people. That's one thing. The second thing that I am very clear on, and that many of my friends and co-workers in the movement were clear on, was that anger is absolutely understandable. But if we are working towards certain goals of creating a new society, we don't have time to get wrapped up in anger. Anger can be there, it can be there for a while, but we don't want it to become a kind of game that we're playing with ourselves and with others. We want to move as quickly as we can on to the alternative. And as we go towards the alternative, the anger moves away because we have other work to do. So I think those two things are very much a part of the story. The anger is wrapped up in the loving concern and commitment, and the anger is put in its place by remembering what our goals are. And if we know that, then we don't have to worry. Some of us feel that the only way that you can be authentic is to be as angry as possible. Well, that's all right, but sometimes you don't have, that's a luxury, to be as angry as possible for as long as possible. Some of us have already discovered in our lives, I'm sure, that while we are going around being terribly angry at people who have done things to us, those people are off on another life altogether, and we are still wrapped up and wrenched by the anger. And what that means, of course, is that they have won and we have lost, because we are still tied up in the anger. And I don't think that any of us wants that to be our goal. Thanks you very much for that, Don. Let's take one or two other questions from earlier today, if they are here, and then we'll go on with this evening's part of the dialogue. Anyone else want to ask anything, say anything? Uh-oh, that's right. We are working out our historian. That's great.
Good evening. My name is Shirley Stewart Jones.
I didn't get the first name, my dear.
Shirley.
Good.
I am from Chicago, and my mother's name is Alma Bell Austin, and her mother, Rita, was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and migrated to Chicago with her seven children. I was not here this morning. I did not have the opportunity to hear you this morning. But I would like to ask you, if Martin Luther King Jr. was here today, do you think he would believe that we have met our dreams, or are we still on that journey to meet those dreams? And how, as a unit, as a nation, can combine together to make that journey in one giant step?
Thank you, Sister Shirley. I think my brother Martin, I know my brother Martin was a very wise person. And if we would take the time to spend hours with just that one famous speech that we call the I Have a Dream speech, if instead of taking just a paragraph or two out of it, but went deeply into it and read it carefully, we would see that Martin was not looking for any miracles to come forth instantaneously, because 250,000 people gathered in Washington, D.C., for instance. My strong sense, Sister Shirley, is that Martin would be encouraging us to keep singing that song, "I'm on my way." He would remind us that the building of a beloved community is not done just by the passing of very necessary laws. For instance, one of the set of sentences from that March on Washington speech, and remember, by the way, that that was a march for jobs and freedom. One of the phrases that many people like in that speech, Sister Shirley, is Martin's voicing a deep desire that the day would come when his four children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And usually people say, yeah, exactly, wow, yes. But Martin would be wise enough to ask us to think about the parentheses around all of that and ask us, oh, by the way, how do you get to know the content of another person's character? How do you get to know the content of a child's character? Can that be done living as separate from each other as we do racially still? Or are we looking for some easy way out, some solution that is not a real solution? Martin, I think, would push us to ask hard questions of ourselves. And I think he would at the same moment be encouraging us, Shirley, to say to us, you can do it. You can find the way if you are deeply committed to find the way. But do not look for simple solutions, like color blindness, for instance. Neither he nor I nor most people of color I know want to be not seen. Amen. Our color is a deep, deep part of God's gift to us. And if we can think of it in that way, we will not be blind to the color. We will just think of different things when we see the color than we do now. My Muslim sisters and brothers say that the Quran teaches us that God made such a great variety of people just so that we could praise God for God's great creativeness in making such a wild bunch of folks. So I would say, my dear, trust Martin to move with some wisdom, always some humor, and always some determination on these things. Martin knows, would know, that the kinds of tasks that he encouraged us to take on were not meant to be accomplished in an hour or in one generation even, but that we have a long, long time to work. And some of us need to say to ourselves and to each other, I'm on my way. I am setting myself on this task, and I'm not going to turn back or be turned back, whatever happened. So, Sister Shirley, that may be more than you were asking for, but let's just say we'll be very, very open and gracious with each other and give each other more than we ask for. And life is always beautiful when you get more than you asked for anyway. One other set of questions or comments. Wow, we are really taking this dialogue seriously. After you finish over there, Mark, we have a hand up front here.
Good evening, Dr. Harding. Sorry about my voice. I'm Larry Lamar Yates. I grew up mostly in Durham, North Carolina, Vietnam, and Thailand.
And the name is Larry, is that it?
Larry, okay. Yes, sir. My mother's mother was Louise de Kreiker, born Louise de Kreiker in Grand Rapids, Michigan, from one of the many Dutch families up there. I was not here this morning, but I want to just express something that I'm sure a lot of us are bringing to this, but certainly that I am personally, which is a deep gratitude, personal gratitude to you. And I know you can't separate yourself from the movement. I understand that. But the speech at Riverside Church in 1967 changed my life in some ways. I heard about it maybe a week afterwards and remember being deeply moved. And There Is a River, that book of yours, has really been one of the most important books in my life. I actually have worn out one copy of it. So I've turned to it over and over again, and I really think everyone should read that history of our nation from that perspective. So I just want to say thank you.
Brother Larry, thank you very much. It's a gracious gift to have someone testify to that kind of effect from something that you do. And I, of course, continue to testify to the fact that all that I have done has been given to me. So we pass on the gift, the love, the capacities, and I hope that you continue to pass on the things that you've read. I feel very strong and deep about that Riverside speech in many, many ways. I feel that it is more than a coincidence that my brother was assassinated 1 year to the day after he offered that speech. And of course, I feel something very conflicted within me, knowing of my own contribution to that speech. So there's a whole lot involved with that. Thank you, Larry. I hope that we can talk some together after this time. Mark, someone, oh yes.
My name is Shirley Ann Hershey Showalter. And I grew up in Lititz, Pennsylvania. My mother's name is Barbara. She'll be 87 tomorrow.
Bless her.
And my mother's mother's name was Anna Mary. And Brother Vincent, I know you have been very engaged in the project Veterans of Hope and that you've worked with young people for many years of linking them with their elders in the movement. And I'm wondering what you have learned from young people in this project.
Thank you, Shirley. It's good to see you again. Thank you for that question. One of the joys of being an elder for me is staying in as deep contact as possible with my young sisters and brothers who are trying to find their way into life. One of the things that I've learned is that many of them are indeed trying to find their way. They're not just sitting around. They're not just going to the malls. They're not just sending tweets. They are trying to find their way and trying to understand how they are connected to that which came before them. And I am deeply impressed by how much some of them are wrestling with the question of how does this which happened in a past relate to me now, and how does it call me to help create a new future? I find, and maybe that's just the kind of folks that I attract around me, I find that most of the young people I meet and are able to engage in serious conversation are really wrestling with real issues about themselves, about life, about the meaning of this country. And so I am greatly encouraged by them and find them to be wonderful companions on the way. And I can't help but constantly remember the kind of young people that you heard in that music at the outset. So many of the young people of today, while they don't have the same kind of outlets that that young woman in Birmingham had, still they are carrying on the same determined struggle to be on their way. And they essentially say the same thing by words or actions. I'm going to ask my mama if I can go. If she says no, I'm going to go anyhow. If you won't go, don't hinder me. I find them teaching me that that spirit did not end in the 60s and the 70s, that there were still young people who want to let that spirit inhabit them now, even though it's sort of scary to be inhabited by a spirit that can get you into trouble. John Lewis, blessed John Lewis, in his autobiography, reminds us that his parents used to say to him down around Selma and Troy, Alabama, when he was a teenager, "Don't get into trouble, don't make trouble." And John said that only as he grew and became a part of the movement that he determined that, yes, he had to make trouble. He meant to make good trouble. And that's what he spent his life doing, and that's what he's still doing. I have a feeling that some of the young people of this generation, surely, are going to be making good trouble. I want to be standing with them as long as I can. And I want them to know that there will always be elders who will be standing with them, not primarily criticizing them, not talking about how they wear their pants or their hair or their fingernails, but wanting to love them into life as I was loved into life. So that's about what I would say right now, Shirley, in terms of what I've learned and what I've seen. Let me pick up from there to some of the other things that I was hoping in this day to be able to share with you as a part of the ongoing dialogue. Before I came on campus, my brother Mark told me that some people were intrigued by the title, Is America Possible? Well, sometimes I'm intrigued by it too. Let me try to indicate where that is coming from. First, I have been deeply affected by a young man whose name I don't know. All that I know is that back in the early days of NPR, when I first began to be a junkie and listened to almost everything that I could on NPR, I heard a set of interviews that was being carried on all over, especially the non-white world. And most of the people who were being interviewed were people who were involved in anti-colonial struggles all over the world as they were breaking out everywhere in the 1960s. And this young man came from the west coast of Africa. Gee, if you were here, I don't know whether he was from Liberia or not, but what I know and remember is that it was the west coast of Africa. He'd been in struggles there. And when he was asked to identify himself, he said, I am a citizen of a country that does not yet exist. And you hear, of course, the unspoken undertone. I am building the country that I will be a citizen of. That caught my attention, and then especially towards the end of this last century, it seemed more and more to me to be absolutely appropriate for many of us in the United States of America, people of color, Anglos, LGBT folks, folks of all kinds of newness and strangeness and beauty, coming to a new sense that this country is not a finished piece of work, that it is not a kind of piece of white granite that you are given and told, here, love it or leave it, or take it or leave it. No, that this country is much more like a dark, dark clay, very malleable, still being shaped. A country that does not yet exist except in our imagination. the country that we believe ought to be. That's one piece of what has been opening me as I think of this matter of, is America possible? Then I am also constantly driven by a letter that I received from a dear friend of mine some months ago. He, coming out of the experience of having been the first black mayor of Berkeley, California, and having been deeply involved in politics and American life, in progressive manifestations for many, many decades. His name is Gus Newport. And Gus wrote this letter to some of us who are part of a new organization called the National Council of Elders. And he said, what we need to remember is that this great American experiment in creating a multiracial democracy . We need to remember that this great experiment in a democratic nation of many, many origins, we need to remember, he said, that this experiment is still in the laboratory. Again, the message, no finished product that we somehow have to take in as it is. But instead, it's a call to stand in the laboratory, to be ready as anybody in the laboratory is ready to make mistakes of many kinds. But to be committed to work at creating something that maybe no one else can see but us. That's what I think of. Now, there are two other things that may help you understand what I mean when I bring this term, is America possible? One of them might seem very heavy to some of you. I've had the great privilege of spending some time with the great Buddhist teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, who first came to this country from Vietnam in 1966 to visit with Martin King, because Martin had nominated him for a Nobel Peace Prize. And when he came to the country, he came to visit Martin at the SCLC headquarters in Atlanta. And at the time, I was teaching on the campus of Spelman College in Atlanta. And when some of us found out that Thich Nhat Hanh was going to be coming into the city, we just did everything that we could to get him to come to the campus of this historic black institution and to spend some time with students that he might never have another chance to see and meet, and they not another chance for him. When he came, he spoke to the students, and any of you who have heard Thich Nhat Hanh or seen him, by the way, how many of you have seen or heard Thich Nhat Hanh in action? Okay, a few. Good, good. A very small, diminutive, gentle, seeming almost fragile man. And this is what he said that I remember more than anything else. He said that he came into the country through California. and 66, California, filled with anti-Vietnam War action on the part of students. And he said, everywhere I went, the students were moving, the students were rising, the students were shouting, out of Vietnam now, we want this done now, now. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, I took some of the students aside and I said, my friends, I am so happy that you want to be in solidarity with our struggle. But I'd like you to think about this. I represent a movement that has been in struggle against foreign domination for 400 years. And I think that you Americans are going to have to learn how to struggle with patience. And of course, we Americans do not like to put those two terms together at all. For us, struggle means right now, at least by the time I graduate, and let's take care of it. I think that that is something for us to put in the back of our collections as we think about, is America possible? And how long will this take? The other thing that I want to simply share with you as a part of understanding what I am meaning by is America possible is that wonderful poem by the dear brother Langston Hughes, who back in the 1930s, in the midst of the Depression, wrote the poem with the words that many of you are at least familiar with. America, you've never been America to me. Now that's hard stuff. And a lot of us would like to say nothing more than that. You've never been America to me. And just say it and say it and say it. But Langston would not stop there. Langston went on. America, you've never been America to me. But I swear this oath, you will be. Your hope lives like a dream in me. I would like to have you be with Langston, be with Thich Nhat Hanh, be with Gus Newport, be with my sister, who I have not mentioned for some time. What was her name? Who wrote out of Jackson, Mississippi? And wrote about her view of America and of black people in America. This is terrible. No, not quite. This is an African American who was on the faculty at Jackson State in Mississippi in the 50s and 60s. How I wrote, Jubilee was the name of the Margaret Alexander. Her name would not come, but what I remember is that she, like Langston, continued to dream of new possibilities for America and for black people in America. Margaret Walker Alexander. That is the gang that I would like to bring you in touch with as we think about what does this mean? Is America possible? Here is where I'd like you to come back now more actively into the dialogue. If you were dreaming America, if you were dreaming of an America that would be good for your children and other children, and for children from all over the world, what would that America be like? What would be some of the characteristics of that America? What would its schools look like? What would its cities be like? What would its foreign policy be like? What I am suggesting is that it is absolutely necessary to dream a new America before there can be a new America. And I'd like to encourage you to do a little dreaming. If we had a bit more time, I would put you into small groups and let you do that dreaming together. You guys have the rest of the year here. I don't. Sometime in the rest of the year, there should be some dream gatherings. What is a new America? Who occupies it? How do people live in the new America? Anybody want to start off with some ideas about a new America for them and for their children and for the wonderful possibility that we might even discover that all children are our children? Just think of a new America in that way. If this America contained grandchildren who were all ours, regardless of what they look like, all ours, Titus Bender would have 22 of them. All ours. Then what would we want for them? In Harrisonburg, in Washington, D.C., in Chicago? What would be part of your dream for a new America? Yes, friend.
My name is Bonnie Price Lofton. I'm the Bonnie that spoke to you on the phone on Sunday night.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Bonnie.
I don't know who my mother's mother's mother was. My mother's mother was a housewife.
That's who I'm asking for, your mother's mother, not the great-grand, just your mother's mother.
Lenore, North Carolina.
Okay. Where did she spend her childhood?
She spent her childhood in Lenore, North Carolina, and my mother did too.
Okay, and what about you?
I was born in Tarboro, North Carolina, but we left at when I was age 4. My father was fired for being a school principal in favor of integration of the white high school that he was in.
Oh boy, oh boy. Bonnie, you just struck a chord with me, and it's one that my dear wife and I are constantly talking about, and that is that we need to find some way to let white people know about white heroes like that, so that they will know that the struggle for a new society is not made up just of Martin Luther King Jr. and some more wonderful black people. Amen. But that white people have risked themselves, including risked their living, in order to do what they believe to be Jesus' calling in their lives. So Bonnie, excuse me for interrupting you, sir, but I feel very deeply about that. I was very close to one of those heroes named Clarence Jordan and to another one named Ann Braden. And I know that it would be good for high school young people who are white and black and college age to know that such white people existed and do exist.
Thank you.
Thank you, my dear, and thank your daddy if he's still around.
He died in 1998.
Okay,
and
you can
still
thank
him. I don't know why
he
wasn't part of a movement. He just did what he thought was
yes,
right.
Yes, yes. You don't have to be part of the movement to do what's right. Okay.
What I wanted to ask you is, I read your letter on the internet, your open letter to President Obama, where you reacted to his order of the killing of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, and was very moved by that letter. And I found myself wondering, President Obama is our first black president, and before that, there was Condoleezza Rice, who was Secretary of State, and Colin Powell, who's Secretary of State, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And it doesn't seem like the policies have changed, even though we now have African Americans in leadership positions. And I wonder what your thought is about that.
Wait a second, don't give away that mic so quickly. I have a suspicion, Bonnie, that you have some thoughts about that. And I'd like it to be a real dialogue where I would respond not just to your question, but to some of your thinking about this as well.
It's truly a question. I guess I feel as though there's some, you talked about it in Beyond Vietnam speech. Martin Luther King talked about it, but you channeled it for him. And those issues that you raised in Beyond Vietnam, that he and you raised, are still with us today. The whole question of the systemic problems of basically our social economic system. I don't have an answer. I was hoping that you, since you wrote Beyond Vietnam 40 years ago, 40 or 50, how many years? Decades ago.
Good.
What you think now.
Bonnie, thank you so much, and thanks for allowing me to push you a little. I think that this is a very teachable moment for us. I had an old... I always have to stop when I start talking about old people that I've known. Recognizing I'm talking about myself after a while. I had a dear old friend who was almost totally a lifelong Marxist. His name was C.L.R. James. And he was a very active, engaged, provocative intellectual whose specialty was working on the overthrow of the French in Haiti. And he wrote about many other things, but I remember one conversation, especially at a point when there was a tremendous amount of talk among us about blackness and the need for more blackness. And C.L.R., smoking one of his long cigarettes, would lean back and say, "Oh yes, blackness. Yes, blackness is absolutely necessary, but not sufficient." I think that one of the things that we learn from this development historically now over the last dozen years or so is that black persons going into a set of structures that have been created by others for certain kinds of purposes that as they go into those settings, unless they are ready to face going through hell, they don't know what to do to break through those structures and to avoid repeating the same deadly practices. One of the reasons why I write these letters that I never even know whether our president ever sees them is because I really believe that he's a better man than he has been. And I think his mama was a magnificent woman. My sense is that not only do we learn that you can't create certain new realities simply by putting new colors in, but it reminds me of the prologue to the Constitution. It reminds me that we are not being a truly democratic society when we keep pointing to the president as magic doer, when the democratic vision is we, the people, are the ones who are responsible for creating a more perfect union, a better nation, a more humane society. Not the president primarily, but we, the people, primarily. If we could, Bonnie, I think spend more time, one, remembering that, two, sharing that memory with each other, and three, asking each other, well, how do we act this out in the midst of the kinds of things that we see going on? That unless we do that, we miss our responsibilities as citizens. And for me, the role of citizen is second only to the role of child of God. And I think we have to nurture that sense of what it means to be a citizen of a democratic society, or we will lose the democratic society and let it go into the hands of those, for instance, who believe that security comes first and democracy comes third or eighth. If we don't take over our work, others have lots of work that they want to take over for us while they keep us involved in who is in football right now or who is selling the biggest cars right now. They keep us involved in all kinds of foolishness while they do the work that we the people should be doing. I think that, and this is not simply a way out, it is for me a way in. I think that our president needs much, much prayer. And I think he needs a lot of letters. And I think he needs conversations going on in communities all over this country. Not focused just on him and what he is or is not doing, but again, as I said, raising up a new sense of who are we and what should we be doing. It's with all of that in mind that I would want to recognize the movement of the hands on the clock and to suggest that what I've really been trying to say is that I believe America is possible, but it is only possible as we take hold of our responsibilities, not just to be good citizens, but to nurture our children in such a way that they will understand that their major role in life is not to get a big bank account, but to live out all the ways of compassion that they can in this country and outside of this country. From the little that I know these days about Eastern Mennonite University, I think you still have the capacities, the possibilities of helping America to be. But it has to become a very active spot on your radar and return to again and again. And don't wait until the next time I come, because nobody knows when that's going to be. But do it the next time you guys are together. And bring yourself together for the purposes of wrestling with these issues. It seems to me that for a college like this, a university like this, there could be no better purpose than helping people to understand what it means to be we the people, and to offer that understanding to as wide a spectrum of human beings as you can. I'd like to stop by encouraging you to do what Mennonites always do, and certainly what all the black people I hang out with always do, and that is to sing some together. What I'd like to suggest is that we close out this part of our time together by singing a song that has been important to me in my own life and in the struggles to try to create a new America, a song that most of you know the tune to, "We Are Climbing Jacob's Ladder." But this time, I'd like us to sing it to words that fit this particular experience that we've been wrestling with. And that is, we are building up a new world. We are building up a new world. We are building up a new world. We are building a... Builders must be strong. Builders must be strong. You guys are so Mennonite that you're wonderful. So you have to do a second stanza. Courage, sisters, don't get weary. Courage, brothers, don't get weary. Courage, people, don't get weary, though the way be long. Courage, sisters, don't get weary. Courage, brothers, don't get weary. Courage, people, don't get weary, though the way be long. And then a last stanza, since all songs have to have a last stanza. Rise, shine, give God glory. Rise, shine, give God glory. Rise, shine, give God glory. Children of the light. Rise, shine, give God glory.